service. We did not promise that. The only thing we truly promised is that when the gathering of the clan takes place, live, audio, on the air, through this repeater, like right now, we'll do the best we can to answer any reasonable question. And if Mel wants to answer some of those emails, because he feels these are brand new hams that need some help, they're not on the air and can't ask us questions directly. I understand that. But you send him your college course homework problems, or you ask him a question of where you want him to select for you the best rig he should buy brand new. These are inappropriate questions. There is no guarantee you're going to get an answer if you write in a question. We did not promise that. If you're willing to take the risk of sending in a question and hope your question is the kind that Mel thinks is valid to be answered, go for it. But we did not promise that. It's above and beyond a call of duty that he's doing that. That's an opinion. Be kind to each other. I'm going away. Hopefully Mel will continue. K2KEY in the TechNet. K2RIW clear and listening.
Tech, before you leave, KB1IFY, I got one for you.
Go ahead, IFY.
Yeah, that radio, you said you like some, that all mode radio. I believe on our website down here, the Stanford Amateur Radio Association, I believe there was one for sale there. Over there has one for sale.
Okay. Radio-wise, and you're not making any profit on it, TS711A, what do you believe is the asking price?
I'm not sure, but if you look on the website, you can contact them and ask them to look for it.
Okay, you have to transmit a little bit lower audio. You're dropping out of the machine. Is it more than 200 and less than 500?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, what the price of it was. I put on there, and I heard you, it's been on the website for a while. I'm pretty sure he still has it. I can't guarantee you that, but, being you say you like it so much, I thought you'd want to look it up and just see what it says.
Understand, I already own two TS711s and a TS811. I love the rig so much, I own a total of three of them, you could say. Bye-bye for now. Thank you for the information. Mel, you got it. I'm going.
Hey, Dick. Take care. 73 to you. Stay well, and we'll look for you next week here. Yeah, as Dick just said, I try to pick out of the mailbag basically and answer many of them as possible with whatever, time I can devote to it. It's new hams with basic amateur radio questions, and I pick out some of the interesting ones, and I bring them up here. So if you are going to submit something, make it basically amateur radio. Keep it in the realm of amateur radio, as Dick says. I know we've gotten, both of us, gotten several I think they either were for masters or in a master's program, or maybe for PhD, pages and pages of intricate mathematics and all. Very flattering that you feel that we could handle it, but not quite what the intent of this amateur radio net is about. So, with that, anybody want to ask any questions or whatever, or should we continue? Over.
K2KYQ.
K2KYQ, go ahead, please.
Good evening, Mel. Handle here is Joe. Very simple. Is that an old Kenwood TS-130 thing? Other than that, it's got me tuning through 40 and 80 meters. I come across signals up there that are kind of strange. I assume there's some kind of digital signal involved in it, but as you're rolling through the single sideband area, you suddenly hit an area maybe about 5 kc wide that goes, you'll actually hear tones. Ding, 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 ding. Or you go in the other direction, it goes ding, 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 go up and down. And they're very melodic tones, and I don't know what I'm hearing. The tone changes as you're rotating the dial. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard several of these so-called ghostly type signals, especially on 30 meters, very prevalent on 10 megahertz, that you hear these type of signals of buzzes and things. Is that what you're referring to, that they sometimes sweep across the band? Over.
No. They're not they're not moving across the band. At the time I've heard them, they were on a particular frequency with a bandwidth of, as I recall, either 3KC or 5KC. But as you rotated the dial through that bandwidth, the tones, it was just like stepping through the tones. Ding, 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 ding. You know, it'd go down in one direction, you'd go past it, then you'd come back and would ding, 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 step back up again. You've never heard that, I guess, huh?
No, not particularly that. I've heard some... No, not with the ding, 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 but I could say I've heard some unusual signals. Anybody on frequency has experienced similar situations? Over.
WB2HWW.
Hey, there's the man. I bet you have had the similar experience. Go ahead, Howie.
Probably hearing a carrier and then tuning in close to the PS-130 and you're using 165 steps. You're inside the engine and you're just hearing a carrier.
Howie, you're very noisy into the repeater, extremely noisy. In fact, you dropped out a little bit, so if you can get into a little better location. I think you said you are familiar with it, but we got very little copy on you, Howie. Over.
I believe I'm trying to say WB2EAV.
Is any better now?
First Howie, and then we'll listen to Ed. Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, you hear?
Unfortunately, Howie, you did not make it through. All right, stand by one, Howie. Let's hear what Ed has to say. W2EAB, go ahead, please.
I think what Howie is saying, some have digital tuning, that it's not continuous, that the tuning steps. And if you're tuning past the carrier, you will pitch change in the same discrete step that the receiver tuning is varying.
Okay, so in other words, you're assuming that because of the type of tuning that they use, that Varac, the tuning that has the, what the heck they call that exactly, that that pulse tuning on that they use, you believe that is what he is hearing, over.
Well, that's the theory. I don't know if it applies to that particular rig. I think that's what Howie was trying to say. I did hear one or two words that made me realize that. The station who called in, do you know if that rig has some kind of discrete tuning and specific steps?
Yes, K2KYQ, Joe. This is an old rig. This has got to be about 25 years old. It's a Kenwood TS-130SE. So there's nothing fancy about it. And I don't hear this on other, you know, I've only heard it on 80 and 40 at different times. And when I do hear it, it's on a particular frequency. So there's something going on. It's either some digital communications, possibly. It doesn't sound like the usual stuff that I've heard. But what happens is if I happen to be tuning across the band and I come on the signal, it's a regular, it sounds like a series of little dings, you know, little bells. Ding, 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 ding. You know? It's just strange. And I would agree that it probably has something to do with whatever I'm hearing, has something to do with a digital thing. But, you know what I'll do? I'll try to record this thing. I got a little recorder here, and I'll try to catch it on a recording and bring it down to one of the meetings. Anyhow, I'll turn it back to you guys and see if there's any more thoughts on that.
AC2QAQ.
Ed, go ahead.
Yeah, the TS-130S, is that the radio that you're talking about right now? And when you were listening on sideband. You were in the sideband mode. And when you were passing by, was it a carrier that you were passing by near a shortwave band? KC2QIQ.
Okay, yes, in sideband mode, and I didn't catch that very last part. I was tuning down the band, let's assume I'm on 80 meters. I was down around 3950, let's say. And as I rolled through 3950 for a period of almost 3 to 5 kilohertz, I would hear these stepping tones as I moved the dial. Go ahead.
Okay, this is my guess of what's actually happening here. You're tuning across a carrier. At that part of the band, I think somewhere around 3885 to 3.9 in that area, you do have some AM operation up there. And your radio's on sideband. So it could be happening is that you have a carrier that you're tuning past, and what's happening is you have a digitized dial. Even though your dial feels very smooth as you're turning the dial, it's actually in steps. So as you turn that dial, it's not fluid tuning as it goes through. Your dial is actually digitally stepping as you're turning it. If you look at your digital readout, you'll see it move, just as Ed was describing before. And what's happening is as you're tuning past the carrier, you're hearing the pitch of the sideband detection beating against the carrier as you're moving by. So it's a mixture between there's a carrier that's fixed, you're tuning past it, and what you're hearing is your radio is creating that tone or pitch shift as you tune past a fixed carrier, an AM carrier, while you're listening on sideband. Does that make sense? It's KC2 QIQ.
Here's another one. What happens when you let go of the tuning arm?
Absolutely what it is.
Hey, thanks out there, guys. Nothing happens when I let go of the tuning knob, but that makes sense what you just said there. Unfortunately, this rig doesn't have an AM mode on it, so I'll have to fire up one of the other radios that does have AM on it, and I probably will find an AM signal. That does make sense. Well, gee, a mystery solved. And thank you, guys. I appreciate that. This is K2KYQ, Joe, and thanks, Mel.
Sounds like a reasonable explanation for that. What you can do is try, I could say, another radio. This condition, Joe, do you hear it constantly on this one frequency? Because there are some AM stations that are operating up there on the proportion of 75 meters. Do you hear it on only this one particular frequency, or any time you tune across any of those? In other words, is it showing up in several places? Over.
Yeah, it shows up in different places at different times. I think the AM signal is probably a good explanation. I do have a, let's see, the 706 MK2G, which I haven't used very often on the HF band, so I'll fire that up one night and switch the antenna over if I come across it again. And I hear it on that particular band, but not on the same frequency. So an AM signal kind of makes sense. And yes, this is a sort of like a hybrid. I've got a continuously tuning dial with a digital display off to the side. So, hey, thanks a lot, Mel. And thank you to all the guys that checked in there. I'll be standing by for a little while. K2KYQ.
Hey, Joe. Very good. Yeah, I've never tried that experiment, but I never experienced that. I'm sure I've tuned across some of the sideband stations, in sideband position, but most likely didn't do it with one of like the radio I have. Produce the same effect. I will try it sometime. I have a Kenwood TS-830, which would most likely be very similar in vintage and all as your radio. I believe they were somewhere in that neck of the woods produced in those years, in the 80s or so. So I will try that just as an experiment, Joe, tuning with that radio that has that basically, I guess, the same kind of tuning with the digital readout and all, but that dial, I forgot what they call that index dial in there. They have a specific name for that wheel, and see if it produces the same effect. Okay, anybody have anything else they would like to ask? We have exhausted all amateur radio questions. Not quite, I guess. Yeah, one of the questions here, I'm just looking in my accumulation here of mail, and one of the questions that also from the newer ham about, you know, we were talking about purchasing secondhand equipment and about the specs that you see on the newer equipment to selectivity as compared to what is expected on some of the older radios, you know. I guess that scares off a lot of people that are maybe coming into the hobby, and they say, oh my God, you know, the specs on the new equipment, I can imagine if I look up the specs, if I can find them on some of these radios that are 20 years old, you know, almost makes it sound as if, gee, these radios are almost unusable because, of course, the improvement in receiver technology. So I have this one here that was asking about that question, you know, about selectivity and what can be tolerated. So I was going to say, I can give you a few instances where it shows you still can use these radios. Let me let it drop. Hey, if you look back, even on, we were talking about Collins a few minutes ago with Dick. You know, if you look back on Collins, you make some measurements, like I made measurements with the Collins. And I found that, for instance, compared to today, the rejection, the bandwidth at a rejection of, say, 60 dB, I made some measurements using, like, the heck was my criteria again? Oh, I think I used, like, something like 50, between 50 and 100 microvolts for F9 and using a two-tone generator. Wanted to see, you know, what these receivers, the old receivers, were capable of. And, of course, compared to what's new now, it's quite a bit of difference because, like, even on my Collins receivers, like the 75S3B, that at 60 dB rejection would be at, let's say, about 4.5 kilohertz, 60 dB rejection. For 70 dB rejection, I remember it was around 5.1 kilohertz. And so you see how that if you go up to 80 dB rejection, it keeps climbing up until, like, I got as far as like 90 dB rejection, and it wound up at around 6.5 kilohertz. So yeah, you look at that and you say, oh my. But believe it or not, they still work real quite well, these receivers. Anybody want to make any comments about this K2KEY listening? Okay, well, all right. Well, that's just in passing, because that question has come up also, you know, can you use one of the older receivers like Joe was just mentioning on this TS-130 if it's still a viable radio to use? Transmitter-wise, if you listen to rigs that are 20 years old, most of them still sound excellent. They sound as good as, you really cannot tell the age of a radio if it's, you know, working properly as far as the transmitted end, because many of them sound excellent. Of course, like, again, the big, advances in technology has been in the receivers. That's really where we have seen tremendous growth in the what is capable in receivers today. Okay, let's see. Another question has come up. Let me let it drop. Then an article that was written in, a number of these questions, a lot of confusion. February 2009, there's an article in QST called Keeping Current with Antenna Performance. And it's a whole article about using another way of measuring SWR, or power, using a thermocoupled RF amp meter. And, I guess it gives people an idea that maybe that their SWR measurements using an SWR bridge is not the final answer to tuning their rig into the antenna. I wonder if anybody has read that article or have any comments on it. Over. Hey, nobody has any comments about it. All right. Well, anyhow, I have experimented in this realm with a situation that I found that I couldn't quite understand what was happening. I have a full-wave loop. We talk about 80 meters, 75 meters. I have a full-wave loop that's 270-some-odd feet of wire, fed with 600 ohm open wire feeders into a Johnson kilowatt matchbox that uses link coupling. I'm not using any kind of balums or anything. This is back really to the basically what was done with most of the systems of transmitters back in the olden days in the 30s. Well, before coax came along, they used link coupling, and you would just slide the link in between two coils and actually adjust your loading by that method. Besides, of course, you had variable capacitors and things, but this was the method of tuning the transmitters mostly of the 30s. And I'm using basically that system. And I found something very unusual was taking place. Let me let it drop. What was happening, if I adjusted the tuner, the Johnson kilowatt matchbox, so that supposedly for minimum SWR, as much as I could dip the meter, I got reports that from my friends that I was making the test with, that my signal was not as strong. If I went back through and then brought the so-called SWR up somewhat, my signal got stronger. If I went the opposite direction, went back again down to the lowest SWR and went up again to past that point, back up to where the SWR climbed up, again my signal got stronger. And I said, what in the heck is going on here? And so I put the two RF amp meters in each one. I put an RF amp meter in each one of the 600 ohm line feeders. And I noticed what was happening, that at the point where the minimum SWR was also less current going into the feeders. When I swung it over that way and peaked the RF output into either one of the lines, the signal got stronger. So showing you that really, I was proving almost that same exact test that they're alluding to, that there is more to it than using the SWR bridge. Anybody want to make any comments on it? This is KC2QIQ.
KC2QIQ.
Hey, go ahead, Glenn.
This is really just an opinion on my part, but I think this is what really makes a very good argument for the Balun. What's actually happening, I think, at that point is that you're getting a mixture between, in other words, what your tuner is tuning in terms of VSWR and line match is the differential, in other words, between both lines coming in from your ladder line. Now, if you start having common mode currents that are running back over the outside that are equal to both sides, and you're creating an imbalance, you're going to get the maximum power to the transmitter, not just with the differential coupling, but with the common mode coupling. Where if a Balun is used in place, what's basically happening is you're stopping the common mode currents from running back down before your tuner. And this way, when you're doing your differential tuning, and your ground for the radio system and antenna tuner is separate from the antenna grounding system, and you can eliminate a lot of that problem. Let me pass it back to you, Melons. What do you think about that one, KC2QIQ?
I was going to continue and say I thought along the same way. So what I did, I said, okay, let's say maybe it's an idiosyncrasy of the Johnson kilowatt matchbox, because that's why I specified use link coupling. I decided, okay, here's one of the other tuners. I have several of the other tuners. I have the so-called, you know, tuners that became very popular on the market in the last few years, a couple of the popular makes, where they use a rotary inductor and the two variable capacitors in the T-network type of situation. And they have a Balun, of course, so you can match to balanced input. They have a balanced input in it using a Balun in there. And I did the same experiment. Again, doing the precise tuning with the SWR down to a minimum and repeated the same performance to see if there would be any kind of change. figuring that, okay, we'll use the transformer in this situation instead of the link coupling without a transformer. And believe it or not, got the same results, Glenn, over.
Yeah, I can kind of expect that. And I think the reason that you're still explaining this is where the location of the balun is with respect to the feed line and the antenna. I think in order to remove that problem, in other words, you have a grounding system that's going to be on the transceiver itself, a grounding system that'll probably be on the antenna tuner, and of course the loop antenna probably is not grounded at all. It's floating, you know, differentially up in the air. And now you have this ladder line coming into the shack, and you're winding up with common mode interference. Now if you're hitting the balun right on the tuner, the common mode is already, it's shot right past the balun and it's all over the box. But if you were to have the balun remote at least, let's say, 10 feet away from the transceiver and the antenna tuner, and or the coax connection, a short coax connection, let's say 10 feet between the tuner and the balun, I would think that that might resolve the issue. But let me pass back to you, Mel, because I think you have a few more observations, KC2, QIQ.
The number of stations that, there's a number of stations that I've run into on 75 meters and all, the full-wave loop has become a somewhat popular antenna, as you imagine, with all the amount of different versions of it that they've showed in the magazines in the last few years. And, in fact, I found that to be an excellent antenna. They used to, of course, tout the loop strictly with a cloud warmer, an NVIS, an EVIS type of antenna, but I find it works phenomenally well. I've prepared it, basically, I've prepared the loop to my vertical, which is a 65-foot vertical, and the vertical, of course, is somewhat better when for long DXing on 80 meters. As far as comparing it to a dipole, I've compared it to my dipole, which is about 65 feet, and I find that the loop outperforms it at 45 feet. This is the experiment I've been conducting now for the last couple of years, Glenn. And and I thought at first, of course, that maybe it's the way the dipole is facing, so I especially paid attention to that we're broadside to the dipole, just so I could give it the dipole an even chance and comparison to the loop. But the loop always seemed to be quite a bit better in many cases, much, much better than the dipole. It's really more than I expected. Let me let it drop. And a lot of discussions we've had on 75 meters about the situation and all. A couple of other guys said, they observed something unusual also. And I said, what was that? They didn't want to bring the open wire feeders into the shack. I'm doing it through feed through the wall. I got porcelain feed through, right through the wall. In other words, I'm continuous with open wire feeders. I am not using any balun up to the tuner at that time. I went right in, like I say, with the open wire feeders right to the Johnson kilowatt matchbox, balanced input to the link coupling. Now, they didn't want to do that, so what they did is they put the balun outside of the shack so that they could come in with coax. And a couple of them, one of them said, funny thing, I took field strength measurements, and I peaked it strictly with a field strength meter, and then I noticed that my standing waves were somewhat quite a bit higher when my field strength was maximized, saying that what the heck is going on here? But there seems to be a little bit more going on than meets the eye, Glenn, over.
Yeah, here again, I know what the problem is, why that is, and as I said, because it's a mixture between, here's the problem. The loop antenna itself has a radiation pattern that's going to come off of the loop. And you have a feed line that's coming in that's not an ideal VSWR. In other words, there's an impedance changing taking place over the balanced feed line that's coming in. So there's an impedance or range of impedance dropping over that balance, over that, that twin line coming in, that ladder line. So what basically starts happening is you have the radiation pattern effects that you're normally seeing of the loop antenna, but now you've also got a feed line that's radiating, and it has a loop pattern. So what you're really doing is by shifting the VSWR up and down, what you're doing is you're kind of like changing the ratio between the amount of radiation that's coming off of the ladder line as opposed to what's coming off the loop antenna and vice versa. So if you're standing outside with a field strength meter and you're tuning for minimum VSWR at one point, you might get a certain radiation pattern off the antenna, and depending on where the location of the field strength meter is, you have one pattern. You shift it a little bit, now the radiation pattern is a little bit coming off the antenna, and now it's a bit coming off of the ladder line, and that's giving you a different kind of like pattern in field strength. So that's what's happening. Now, how do you resolve that? I think there's a couple of different ways of getting around that, but do you see what I'm saying there, Mel? KC2, QIQ.
I understand what you're saying, of course, God, I know what you're coming from there. The point is, with working with, like, for instance, that loop antenna, the situation is that basically you want to put the best signal out as possible, and I actually can say to you that maybe that ignoring the SWR bridge that is between, of course, the transmitter and the tuner, and going strictly by your antenna currents may be possibly, in a number of these antenna situations, a better way of tuning. So to continue the experiment, I said, okay, I took the dipole. Now, my dipole is fed with 300-ohm open wire feeders, but the ones I'm using on the loop antenna is actually homebrewed. Feeder. It's not a commercial feeder. It's 600 ohm. In other words, it's one continuous wire, the loop antenna. It starts at the shack, goes up to an insulator, goes around the 272 feet, comes back to that insulator, and then comes down again to the shack, and there's homebrew spaces between it. Whereas with the dipole, I'm using what I purchased, 300 ohm wire, you know, that they sell for amateur radio use. I think you're familiar with that that type of feed line that has the punch out that they sell over.
Yeah, I'm using the 600 ohm version of that myself, Mel.
Hey, I thought for the dipole, because the dipole is somewhat of a inverted V, and I figured that maybe the match would be theoretically somewhere in close to 300 ohms up there. And I repeated the same experiment with the dipole, with the open wire feeders, or I should say the parallel feeders, balanced type of antenna. And I got almost the same, very close to the same effect with the RF amp meters in the line, using even the dipole, which leads me to believe that there may be at times, you know, more reason your antenna current rather than standing waves, Glenn, over.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, depending on how the antenna is mounted and the antenna currents, as long as the transmitter can tolerate the VSWR, like you're pointing out, you might be getting the best pattern at a slight VSWR offset. In other words, you may have a slight mismatch. The same can be said even of certain... If you mount a vertical whip on a quarter wave antenna on a car, on a mobile antenna, you might find also that your pattern and bandwidth at 1.7, you know, between 1.7 to 1.5 VSWR will actually give you a better signal than 1-to-1, because the coax is 50, but your actual whip antenna isn't exactly 50. So you're going to find that some VSWR between 1.7 to 1.5, somewhere inside there, is actually going to give you the best signal gain and match. But there again, as long as the transmitter can withstand the, as long as it doesn't damage the transmitter, it should be okay.
Of course, you're not going to damage the KWS-1 or one of those clunkers, you know, one of those big old poop transmitters. In fact, back in the days when I was younger, my first big amplifier that I constructed was Caravate 13 Surplus, used to be able to buy those tubes, like two for a dollar and all. And most people, they tune the amplifiers, which I did, and you got the plates in there slightly glowing red. And so you said, ah, now it's putting out maximum power when they started to glow red inside there. So the tube transmitters, of course, are very tolerant. I always say that now you go out, you buy a new rig, and you have to purchase a separate tuner, which one time came with the transmitter. The tube transmitter basically had, at Pi Network, basically had the tuner built into it, Glenn, over.
Very good, Mel. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's an interesting thing. You know, you look at the you know, the tolerance, but I have to admit too, a lot of your equipment is getting a whole lot better. Just occasionally, you have certain transmitters that are not all that tolerant, and I guess just the rule of thumb when you tell, especially new amateurs, what's the best SWR to go to, it's the lowest you can go, you know, kind of a thing. I'm almost a little skeptical about telling everybody you can get away with, you know, a little bit higher of SWR, and they come back to me and say, yeah, well, I just blew up my transmitter kind of thing. But, yeah, the older equipment, especially if you have those load tuning dials, could tolerate a whole lot more SWR tolerance. And you could play around. They were a lot more flexible in terms of tuning up your antenna and getting the maximum signal performance. Back to you, Mel. KC2, QIQ.
Roger. Well, you see, this is K2KEY. A lot of people misunderstand, you know, what SWR actually means. In many cases, it's very misunderstood. So as you just said, you know, achieving this business of, oh boy, I got to get down as close to 1-to-1 as possible. You know, it's hard to explain that you're not going to hear at the other end a situation where they're going to say, wow, you know, you're such an improvement. What did you do? Well, I got my SWR, say, from 1.5 down to 1.2. You know, that, oh boy, you know, what a difference in your signal. You can go ahead and you can put a lot of effort into reducing that SWR, that little bit, and it's not going to really make any kind of difference. Yes, as you did say, Glenn, that there are many of the rigs, of course, the modern-day rigs, after if it goes above 2-to-1, they're, you know, the system to protect itself begins to pull back the power. But I was just saying, I'm the observing what was going on there and trying to determine, you know, what effect am I getting here, because, you know, not using the SWR bridge as my gospel going over.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely the case, you know, and you're, the best way of proving that always is your field strength meter, just going out there and signal reports, what you hear from other stations, and as long as you're not injuring your equipment and you find a sweet spot in your performance, you mark those settings up, and that's your area of operation. Back with you, Mel.
Exactly. In fact, you know, to have the RF amp meters in the line, it was a bit of a pain. So I put into the line what I have on the lines. I basically put sensors on each one of the lines and thermal sensors. And I'm actually able to read the thermal sensors out. I was reading them out on a dual channel oscilloscope, looking at each line individually on a dual channel scope, rather than trying to watch that those current meters, you know, jump up and down. It's easier to use a scope to actually look at it, you know, the peak-to-peak current on the line. So it was a very interesting, you know, experiment to see what is going on. And I'm, like you say, why I bring it up is many cases that we don't realize that the SWR is being used as a gospel is most, many cases, not doing the best thing for you. As you mentioned with, say, a mobile setup, Glenn, over.
Yeah, you know, it's that's an interesting thing, because I know I was, you know, designing a couple of mobile whips, you know, with mag mounts, and I started finding that problem where, you know, I'm trying to match a 50-ohm cable to a whip, and I've got a loading coil in the middle so I can make it a dual band, you know, 440, 2-meter. And what I'm finding out is that I'm looking at the pattern, because I'm using antenna analyzers, everything else, and I'm like, wow, I'm getting my best, you know, radiation performance, and then checked it with a field strength meter and reports, notes, actually finding out that because the mismatch between the whip, because the whip is never going to be exactly 50 ohms at true resonance, it's really closer to 70, you know, 68 to 70 ohms with the mag mount, and then when you have the 50 ohm cable attached there, you know, it's slightly off. So my actual solution for that one was there again was a ballon. I went back in and I built a tuning ballon that went in the base of the mag mount, so I could tune the 70 ohm wideband match for 440 and 2 meters, and then basically get a good back to 50 ohms, and then I ran the cable through. But then, yes, I have the perfect 50 ohm match. But is it really necessary? Probably not. Back over to you, Mel.
It's a question there. This is K2KEY. You know, we take 50 ohms coming out of the transmitter, the cable, so everything as the gospel that automatically we assume everything is going 50 ohms, which in many cases, like you just said, is not quite 50 ohms. And I've experienced that. I know I saw your mobile that a couple of years ago when you paid a visit that time on field day. I saw what you had on your mobile, which was quite a rig up on there on the mobile. And I know I've also done quite a bit of experimentation, you know, with mobile antennas, trying to find the panacea of the great antenna, and was able to try, you know, borrowing different mobile antennas from different ham friends to try to see which one, you know, will give me the best bang for the dollar. And it's, like you say, it's a rude awakening when you start really making detailed measurements. Not this business of just sticking an SWR bridge in there and saying, oh, well, you know, low SWR has got to be working, you know, extremely well. So like I say, you know, you've got to look a little more in depth. And I think this article in the QST basically tried to bring that out, Glenn, over.
Yeah, very good, Mo. Actually, what year and what month QST was that?
Current issue, February. The February issue, Glenn, over.
Yeah, I don't believe I read that, but I think I'm going to take another look at that one. That's a good point to bring up. KC2, QIQ.
KC2KY, yeah, page 34. Very interesting article. I could see how it generated a lot of questions because I've been questioned about this now several times as to what the heck, if we can't believe the SWR bridge, you know, where are we? What are we doing? You know, and as the article brings out, that the use of thermocouple RF amp meters, you know, you thought it actually died off. You don't see them anymore. You saw a surplus for several years. They were very common if you look back in World War II. A lot of the equipment, ARC, Army Radio Corps, a number of those different radios had RF amp meters. They didn't have SWR bridges. They had RF amp meters built into the rig, so there was a lot of those meters that were around very cheap at one time, Glenn, over.
Yeah, absolutely. You bring up an interesting point. When I used to work for microwave power devices quite a while ago, developing power amplifiers, they really got away from a lot of that because I guess there was a point in time where, you know, everybody wanted to pay for power. And so in other words, when the government would buy an amplifier, they wanted to see a fixed amount of output power on a fixed power meter into a fixed 50 ohm load. And that's kind of the way that everything was sold and understood. So if it wasn't into a piece of coax, into a dummy load, and you saw that power and flatness, you know, that was, you know, it had to be within a tenth of a dB across the band and the whole thing. So it was like they were paying for their power, and they wanted to see, you know, digital readouts of the power numbers and all that sort of thing. And no one at that point in time wanted to see current meters, if you know what I'm saying. KC2QIQ. You
brought up a good point. In the broadcast industry, the FCC on the specifications, or I should say reviewing the transmitter, the broadcast transmitter, usually ask for, you know, current measurements. That's basically how they, wanted the criteria of the operating power. It was by the amperes that are, you know, being delivered to the antenna. And so the broadcast engineers, I remember all the broadcast engineers always had a RF amp meter as their primary test piece of test equipment in the broadcast station, Glenn, over.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing how much the instrumentation has changed and, you know, what's actually used. But, yeah, it's, but they're very, very valid techniques for measuring power. It's just, as I said, everything is kind of like, you know, today with all the analyzers and everything always into 50 ohms, it's just, I guess, the standard today that everybody's being taught and the standard that's kind of accepted.
Exactly. So, you know, many people don't realize that because, again, you know, the gospel of the FWR bridge is doing, you know, everything to tell them how great everything is. And that's why this article here has thrown this all of a sudden into a disarray, that the discrepancies many times between the FWR bridge and the person who wrote the article, he says, and the RF current, using the RF current meter, you know, is could be a tremendous amount of discrepancies there, and which one is right, and also it gives us several ideas on how to, you know, make yourself a homebrew version of a RF amp meter, and it's something to, you know, consider as you know, if you, you know, especially if you're interested in doing antenna experiments, Glenn, over.
I have to admit, though, Mel, I don't own an RF amp meter. I do have my VSWR bridge, and I've kind of been bitten into that 50 ohm bug, if you know what I'm saying. Plus, all my equipment here is 50 ohms, but I am interested in the article, though. That's definitely something I want to take a look at.
Hey, yeah, I would expect. I have never run across any of the hams that were licensed. if they weren't licensed at least 30 years or 40 years ago, they most likely never run across an RF amp meter. On my days, it was very common. As Dick said, that we used, you know, a very common way that Dick and myself started out, and the poor boys, you know, with ham radio back in the 50s. Was using, for instance, number 47 pilot light bulbs to measure both your current on your antenna line and your SWR. Basically, that was my indication. One lamp had a light as bright as possible, and the other one dim. I knew, well, this is my antenna system is working fairly well, Glenn. So the bulbs actually were measuring the antenna current, over.
See, that's funny, just to show you a little bit of a generational difference. Now, I was first licensed in 1978, and I remember tuning up my first CW transmitters, and I would have a box of LEDs that would be sitting on the bench, and when I had a mismatch in a tune, I could actually see the LEDs on the bench start to light up, and I knew I had a mismatch, so the LEDs were an indicator that I had a problem. So, back over to you, Mel, KC2, QIQ.
Change, you know, it's changed in a way, but yet basically we're doing the same thing with more modern techniques today. Our day, everything was, you know, fly-by-wire, what I say, by the seat of your pants, really doing things, because I don't want to start talking about, you know, the rigs that we put together in those days. My first rig basically transmitter was on a wooden chassis, one crystal, with I didn't have a meter even. It was a neon bulb type of, you know, just the brightness of a neon lamp. And your SWR, if you wanted to get that far, it was, like I say, a couple of number 47 panel light bulbs that you put on the line. So, you know, no doubt. Now, you were mentioning earlier, you know, about LEDs. I was going to ask you a question about LEDs. How do you know when you're approaching the maximum brightness of an LED without beginning to damage it, over?
That's a very good question that I've been putting towards all of the manufacturers, and what they do is they keep that one so tightly knit, and what they do is they give you a data sheet, and the way that they've been treating it is very much similar to the way you handle the ratings of a transistor or a diode, and more specifically a diode. And what you can do is, like, the high-intensity ones I've been seeing lately have like something like a 350 milliamp at 3.5 volt rating. So you try to keep 350 milliamps constant through it, and with temperature changes, the currents can kind of be constant, and the voltage can move up and down a little bit. Now, the maximum current they can withstand before they'll pop is usually somewhere around 700 mils, but you don't want to run it anywhere near that. And if you start backing off less than 350, you can find out that the bulb is going to start getting a little on the dim side. So you kind of pick the center point of the LED, which is like somewhere, usually it's on the rating in the data sheet, and you can usually, it'll tolerate 20% to either side, usually, you know, in RMS values on them.
The reason I ask that, my daughter showed me a little flashlight that's about, I'd say 4 or 5 inches long, and has a series of bulbs in there. I think there was about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 lamps in there in a, like a circle. I'm sure you've seen that. This one was so super bright that it was actually, you could say it was a weapon. If you could, you could not even think of looking at that. I've never seen anything as bright as that, so I was wondering, is this something new that has come along in LEDs that I'm not familiar with, or are they just pushing them harder, Glenn, over?
No, it's, you're on the money. It's a newer technology of LED. They're referred to as high-intensity LEDs. They're typically 1 watt outputs. As I said, you know, there's a couple of different types of them around, but the ones I've been seeing are around 1 watt, and they're not something you want to look into. And the ones where they start getting dangerous, where you shouldn't really look into them, is the ones that are like 67 lumens and higher. So in other words, if you have 67 lumens for 1 watt of output, that's an extremely bright LED. You know, that's not like looking at, you know, 3D cells into an incandescent bulb on the end of a high-intensity flashlight. This is something, if you look at it, you'll damage your eye. KC2, QIQ.
I was wondering why that's why they had so many batteries, and I have never seen one that had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 AAA batteries in it. I've seen them with 4, you know, AAA batteries and all, but this one was 5. And she carries it, like she says, at night as a a protection, because you shine that into, I mean, you really, I think, will be instantly, you know, blinded. You, I mean, you'll just quickly try to look away. There's no way that you could tolerate the amount of light that came out of there, because she just turned it on. I just took a peek, and she said, don't even try to look into it. You'll really hurt your eyes. And that's why I questioned if they came up with some new super LEDs that are just coming on the market, or if they're just pushing the ones that are now the high intensity ones hotter to achieve more light power, Glenn, over.
Yeah, these are new series of LEDs that are coming out, and they've been out now for a couple of years, but what's happening is they're starting to make it into the marketplace, and once you start seeing how these things work, compared to, you know, regular LEDs and how they've worked in the past, they can start replacing incandescent light bulbs. They're really fantastic, remarkable devices, and I'm just hoping to see them wind up in more, you know, general products and start replacing incandescent lights, fluorescent lights, and the more people get comfortable with them and they start using them, they're really fantastic, and the different kinds of light and color you can get out of them. I mean, I've seen them where they're bluish in color. You get them into warm white. You can get them in closer to yellow, or, you know, you can virtually get them in all different kinds of colors. And the amount of output you get out of them is higher than you'd get out of incandescent or fluorescent, and a lot more efficient. When you start looking at the power dissipation in comparison to for the amount of light output, you know, it's to give you an example, I was working on a light fixture that was putting out 10,000 lumens. This is a real high-intensity light fixture. And typically to do that with incandescent, this would take like close to a kilowatt of power to power it. And the amount of actual power that's really required to do the same function with LEDs is about 100 watts now.
Roger. Yeah, I know. That flashlight, I'll tell you something. Amazing that it can run on AAA batteries and produce that kind of light. You can light up the room, literally, with it. And I said I envisioned that someday avoid, at least with power independent completely, have them photovoltaic or wind generator or something charging batteries, and at night you can turn the lights on, and with the low drain of these things, you can light to keep your house lit up literally for nothing. So, yeah, I guess this is the future, and we're surely going to see a lot more of it. So, okay, just about midnight. Glenn, thank you very much, as always, for joining us, and best to you, and catch you next week. 73, it's been a pleasure, as always, and everybody else that's listening, thank you also for joining us here on the TechNet. This is K2KEY saying, well, good morning to all, and 73. We'll be talking to you. Take care, Glenn.
Yeah, 73's Mel. Good talking to you and everybody else on the net here tonight. So K2KEY, KC2QIQ, 73's all.
Reflector 9126, link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
Echo link N2STU.
Don't leave any witnesses. Washington, to PPN.
JC, JC.
JC, what's up?
Same old, same old. Another Monday morning.
I hear you. I guess you didn't have a chance to try opening up that mic, looking for the cloth.